Miami Memoirs presents real case histories and true stories related to the law practice and experiences of Florida attorney Lewis M. Ress. Miami Memoirs uncorks a caseload of true, weird, wonderful, and wild stories from an always eventful 6 decades of life in the law. From multi-million-dollar land deals to the ghostly aftermath of an Everglades plane disaster via a prematurely deep-frozen cat, these tales feature a parade of unforgettable characters, all sharply observed by a storyteller with a very human empathy for ordinary and extraordinary individuals caught up in the law.
Lewis has just released a new book, Miami Memoirs, including The Maharani's Ring. Fans of strange cases and wild tales will need no introduction to the author's brilliant and fast-paced storytelling, laced with salty evocations of the human carnival of the era and shot through with compassionate insight. From advising the heir to Colonel Sanders and falling out with Buddy Hackett to nighttime jogging with Vitas Gerulaitis, the stories keep on coming. Larry the charismatic wheeler dealer needs to be rescued from yet another risky deal, and a bridge-playing mobster needs help to find his missing daughter. All this and more, along with sage advice against buying a lottery ticket you might win. Welcome to round two. And now, let's begin.
Hi everyone, welcome to Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Lewis Rez. I'm Jeanette Garcia, your host, and today we are on episode 50. Can you imagine that? 50 episodes that we've done together, Lewis.
Wow. Right?
That's incredible. And today's title is Out of Brooklyn, 1936. So what's this one about? I'm excited.
Well, Jeanette, it's so good to be with you again.
Thank you.
And happy 50th.
Yes.
Congratulations. It's wonderful. Yep, this is Out of Brooklyn. And this comes from Miami Memoirs, the book that I wrote. And it's, you know, a little bit of an interesting history about my background. But it's not a self-laudatory, ego-massaging story. It's a story that might interest people objectively.
Okay.
It's not just about me and my feelings and my emotions. That is in every single novel you get. This is not a memoir of that type. It really tells you about what Brooklyn was like and what my upbringing was like and what the ethics and morals and economics of the times were, which is today you don't find too many people who are still lucid who can remember back to the 1930s.
That's true.
So a lot of it is about what kids were doing in the 1930s in Brooklyn.
I want to hear so much about it.
Out of Brooklyn, about the Brooklyn water bagel store. And they say, it's the water, it's the water. It's a great bagel store. And they have wallpaper in the bagel store with all the names of the people who were born in Brooklyn.
Oh, wow.
And the famous people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Bernie Sanders and Mel Brooks, not the Mo Brooks, but Mel Brooks, the comedian, and Jay-Z and Walt Whitman. I don't know if you remember Walt Whitman.
Oh, yes.
Was a great American poet.
Leaves of Grass, right?
And Bobby Fischer, the chess champ, and... Barbara Streisand, the singer, and Adam Sandler, and they all were, Neil Diamond, and Alan Dershowitz, they all came from Brooklyn. So it's along Danny Kaye, a whole bunch of interesting people came out of Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
So Brooklyn was a creative place, and everybody denigrates Brooklyn with the accent that I have, but it has one of the most wonderful cultural lives there. They have the Brooklyn Academy, and they have the most wonderful performances, and concert performances. And then you have the art museum, the Brooklyn Museum of Art. They have the second greatest collection of Egyptology in the world.
Oh, wow.
And you have Prospect Park, who was laid out by the same architect who did Central Park.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a lot of other wonderful things in Brooklyn. So, and there's a good Brooklyn College, is pretty good. And it's at a lovely campus.
Oh, wow.
So that's about Brooklyn. Anyhow, it starts off by saying, she pulled back her right hand until her hand was upright at the shoulder level. Then she swung hard sideways with an open hand and caught her 5-year-old on the side of his face. Whack!
Ouch.
Slap! You could hear that shot from across the street. The kid screamed. You could see the red handprint on his cheek. That was his mother hitting him. He shrunk backwards. And he put his face in his hands, and he shook all over. He was shaking. And she said, you goddamn brat, you'll listen to me or I'll keep giving it to you.
Whoa, you're kidding me. Did your mother treat you like that?
You bet she did. And I still remember it to this day. And I'm now going past 91, and I remember that as though it happened yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So you talk about trauma to kids.
Yeah.
It wasn't uncommon for mothers to scream and slam their kids around in Brooklyn. But the worst was the fathers, often coming home from riding crowded subway trains, frustrated, with short tolerance levels for misbehaving children. And the kids would try to hide behind their mothers without success. And the kids had black and blue marks on their behinds, on their backs, on their hands, on their face. And they were slammed.
But that's child abuse, right?
Today, it would be child abuse. But in those days, it was keeping your child, teaching them values.
Right.
That was the way you taught them values.
Discipline.
You took out the strap and you gave it to them. So deep in my mind, the words came to me. And anyway, I'm a five-year-old. Get out of Brooklyn. Get out of this. Get away from this.
Wow. At such a young age.
So, and this was 1937 now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 7 years old, and my loving father took off his belt and put me across his knees. My pants were down, and I was about to get it for some sort of an infraction. I don't even remember exactly what it was. And I said, "Dad, hold up. Can I ask you a question before you hit me?" He says, "Sure, go ahead." I said, "Dad, am I your pal?" He said, "Yes." I said, "You wouldn't hit a pal, would you?" Well, my father couldn't do it. He really was a decent guy. He wasn't like the others.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a good reaction. You were really crafty to say that at 7 years old.
Yeah, kids don't underestimate kids. They think.
Yeah.
You know, the young we underestimate youngsters, 5 years, 6 years, seven. They're very impressionable and very smart.
Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, now we're up to 1938 and next year, and the skies were darkening, and our family had lost almost everything in the Great Depression. Stock disappeared in an uncontrolled market. And the self-regulated banks went down the tubes with everyone's savings. Unemployment lingered on, and people were angry.
Is that the result of a free, unregulated market?
Yeah. In those days, and we have a group of people today that are like that, they don't want the federal government to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, they like their Social Security checks.
Right. They
like to get the bills paid when they're sick. They want to go to the hospital. They don't want a bill. They want Medicare to pick it up. So the government has come in and they put in insurance, FDIC, for savings.
Right.
So if you have $100,000 or maybe even more now, your savings are protected by the federal government. That wasn't the case. The bank closed, you were wiped out.
Oh, wow.
And it was a free economy. All these people, these wonderful economists talk about free economy.
Mm-hmm.
And free economy stinks because the whole purpose of government is to put a safety net under people.
Right.
And
keep them protected regardless of the times.
Whether it's fire or police or it's army, it's a safety net.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, 1939, the next year, my parents took me aside. The Nazis were on the march. Jews were being persecuted in Germany. The United States was in another major recession. And my father had just been wiped out in an apartment house investment when the tenants couldn't pay their rent.
Oh, no.
You know, when the tenants can't pay the rent and you're the owner, you can't pay the mortgage.
Of course.
And they foreclose. And the poor tenants are screaming, "Please don't throw us out." And you say, "What are you doing to me? I'm losing my investment in this building."
Of course. That happened a lot now during COVID.
Man.
Yeah.
Man, you know, it's not so good. You know, and everybody worries about the tenants, which is okay. But they don't worry about the owner of the building who's going bankrupt when he couldn't get the income.
Yeah.
So things were looking very bad for the world in 1939. Hitler is going to war, and we'll probably be involved. That's what my parents said.
Mm-hmm.
Be strong, be brave, and look after your sister. Well, to this day, my sister's in her 80s, mid-late 80s. I still look after her.
Of course.
But now she's starting to look after me.
Oh, that's so sweet. Well, that was a tough time, though. You lived through quite a lot.
Yeah.
And so how old were you at this point?
Well, I was 9 years old, and what did I know? Well, don't underestimate 9 years old in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
We knew what was coming, we kids. We were well aware of the world situation. We read newspapers at 9 years old, and we listened to the radio. President Roosevelt made speeches, and the Brooklyn kids played in the street with traffic all around us, and we traveled on the subways and the buses all by ourselves. 9 years old, I was traveling on the subway by myself.
Just living through, enjoying Brooklyn.
Yeah, we had stickball out in the streets, and the cars were coming through and beeping their horns. And we were hitting the ball and running into cars to catch it.
Wow.
And we were tough kids.
And so how was school in Brooklyn?
Well, not so good. That was one of my major complaints. The schools were run like prisons. The major concern was discipline. That's all they cared about.
So there was also hitting at school, too?
Huh?
There was hitting at school as well?
Oh, are you kidding? Are you kidding? They would slam. The teachers could hit you. The principal could hit you.
My
gosh. You go down, the principal had a paddle.
Wow.
And the children marched in dark, smelly, narrow, tile-walled corridors with black floors, two abreast. There was no talking, and monitors reported any fractions. Get a job to clean erasers from the blackboard. Your face was white with chalk dust. Pour ink from a large jug. There was a large jug of ink in each classroom, and you poured it into these little inkwells that were set into the wooden desks. And because we used pens, quills. We didn't have fountain pens then, and there was no ballpoint pens.
Oh, my goodness.
And we actually used wooden sticks with a piece of metal at the end of the tip.
What was that like?
It wasn't so great.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, your fingers get dyed blue, you know, from the ink. And even when you're not dispensing ink, your fingers get dyed blue. And then you have to have penmanship was important.
On top of everything.
Yeah, and you had to have cursory. You had to write cursory with a pointed pen with ink.
Wow.
And if your handwriting wasn't neat, you automatically got an F. And Miss Warriga, the skinny old assistant principal, read from the New Testament every morning at assembly in a strident voice, even though 90% or more of the students were Jewish.
Yeah, I was about to say. So how did you react to that?
Well, those days, they weren't so sensitive about religious freedom, and I felt very uncomfortable as a child. I can remember it sitting here at 91. I can remember when I was 9 years old, sitting in class in the auditorium in public school, feeling like shut out.
Right. Like, what's all this talk about Jesus Christ? What's going on here?
When they were talking about a religion that it was not mine.
Right.
And I was being compelled to participate in it.
Exactly.
And that did not please me.
Yeah.
Of course, I don't like the fact that they added under God in the Pledge of Allegiance. So that's a lot of religious politics.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's appropriate. Anyhow, the cafeteria smelled of chlorine.
Oh.
And, yeah, I can remember the smell. Right now. But the institutional food only cost a few pennies, and we considered ourselves very lucky, and we were. And the voice persisted within me because I was living this thing.
Yes.
It was almost like hell every day. I said, how do I get out of Brooklyn? They weren't teaching. They were disciplining us.
Right.
And you had to sit with your hands clasped straight up at your desk, and you couldn't say anything.
Who can learn like that? You can't learn like
very
that.
Very hard.
No one can learn like that. So what happened next?
Well, next was 1941.
Oh,
well, now you have December 7th, 1941, a day of infamy.
Yes.
And that was the speech that President Roosevelt gave after the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. And we wore name tags made out of whalebone. They actually had whalebone, and they engraved your name and a number on the tag, and you wore it.
Wow.
A circular tag, flat circle.
Wow.
And we wore it around our necks.
Oh, wow. So you lived through World War II. That is incredible.
Oh, yeah. In 1942, the next year, people don't remember, Hitler was winning the war. And young men were being drafted into the military. And there were plenty of jobs because these guys were leaving jobs.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about 1 million men being drafted.
Yes.
Out of the workforce, you know, in the working age. So we tend to forget that we were losing the war for a long time. Mm-hmm. After Pearl Harbor, our fleet was really decimated, and we went backwards in the Pacific. You remember
yes.
the death march at Corregidor and Bataan in the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And MacArthur had to leave the Philippines. He said, I shall return. And I remember those things.
Mm-hmm.
I lived through them.
Yes.
Now,
what was it like thinking, oh my gosh, like the United States is losing? Like, what was that like?
Well, we were scared out of our wits.
Mm-hmm.
We were scared out of our wits. And as a matter of fact, the country overreacted at that time. And we overreacted to the Japanese Americans. And we were worried that they were going to commit sabotage. And we put them in internment camps, which
yes,
I'll tell you more
right.
about. Because there's a wonderful Supreme Court decision, which I'm going to lecture you another time on this United States Supreme Court lousy decisions.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of them where they said it was okay to intern the Japanese Americans.
Oh my gosh.
They didn't do a thing.
Right.
The whole history of the war, they never had an incident. But the Germans, they big Nazi party movement in New York City, particularly
they
in
did
the
nothing.
Bund, they were blowing up places. And they didn't do anything to the Germans because they were white.
Yes.
And Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyhow. Oh, in 1944, I was 14, and I started at a very tough Coney Island High School. That was a tough area, and it was called Abraham Lincoln High School.
Hmm.
My father was an air raid warden, and when the siren sounded, he ran out into the street with an armband and a flashlight, shouting at people to turn off their lights and blowing a whistle.
Oh, my.
Everything was rationed with little coupon books. So you had food and clothing and sugar and meat and gasoline and tires and toilet paper. Everything was rationed. You got a book, and you had so many
that didn't
and shoes.
That was happening here not too long ago. So,
there were no more lockers down at the beach at Brighton Beach. They used to have these lockers where you could change, and there were no more big bands playing in the outdoor band shell. There used to be wonderful bands, Tommy Dorsey and Jimmy Dorsey and Glenn Miller, and all of those big bands played there, Benny Goodman, and you could dance.
It must have been quite a party.
It was a wonderful time before the war.
And were a lot of people in the military?
Oh, yeah, I told you about a million people were drafted, men. And there were small square banners with a red border and a blue star in the center that, and on a white field that you hung, little square like silk banner that you put in the window if a family member was serving in the military. And then it wasn't a blue star, they changed it to a gold star if that family member was killed to memorialize the dead. And there were plenty of gold stars hanging around Brooklyn.
Oh, wow.
In the
That's
windows.
So sad.
Wherever you looked, you saw the banner hanging in a window.
Mm-hmm. And was the war over then in 1945?
Yeah, well, the end of September or so of 1945, we won the war in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
But earlier, we won the war D-Day.
Mm-hmm.
Victory in Europe, VE Day, I think it was. And the world had changed. We won the war. For me, it was wonderful. No more New Testament. No more marching 2x2. There was a goal. I'm in high school.
Yeah.
I'm getting into high school. There was light at the end of the tunnel. And I heard the voice again. The voice deep in my head said, education will get you out of Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Well, that is a very interesting phenomenon because it occurred to me that education was a really helpful thing. When they say, what motivates you in life? I'll talk about motivation.
Mm-hmm.
Something inside of me gave me a clue. Get educated. Get out. And I knew if I got to college, I would get out of Brooklyn.
Yeah.
That's
my
hope.
Path.
That was my hope.
Yeah. And was it tough to get into college?
Are you kidding? It was murder. It wasn't tough. It was awful. There were 5,000 students with three levels of kids at Abraham Lincoln High School. First, there was the tough antisocial criminals. These kids carried knives.
Wow.
And they had fights, knife fights and stuff. And that was a rough crowd. You didn't want to mess with
Mm-mm.
them. A lot of them were on the football team.
Uh-huh.
And then they cut school and they hung around at a candy store across the street from school. They didn't go to class. They were tough. Then they were the complacent kids who had their own cars. They had convertibles and stuff,
mm-hmm.
and they were going into the family business.
Mm.
So they didn't care.
Right.
They weren't going to college. They were going into the family business, and they were going to work for their parents.
Right.
And inherit the business. And then the remainder of us, were fiercely competing to get into the best colleges.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you could get into Brooklyn College or maybe NYU without too many, or City College without too much of a hassle. But if you wanted to go to an Ivy League school, forget it.
Oh,
you had over 900 kids in your graduating class to fight to get in. You could only file three applications for college.
Oh, really?
Only three. There was no computer. There was no internet. And you had to
paper.
Mail them in, and you had to fill them out by hand.
It's interesting that they had that limit.
All the recommendations in writing and letters separate for each application, and the school had to process them and stamp them. And you got 900 kids, and they're going to run an office with secretaries to do this.
That's a lot.
And it's not fair to the school.
Right.
So, and of course, the kids didn't have much of a chance to compete with the wealthy kids.
So of course, yeah.
And then 1946 comes along, and the troops were coming home.
Mm-hmm.
They were still coming home, and I joined the USO group, to entertain the troops.
Oh, okay.
And we put on shows at military hospitals. There was a big military hospital over in Staten Island. And we would go on the bus from school over to Staten Island and have dinner in the cafeteria at the hospital and then entertain the veterans.
So what did you do? What was your role?
Oh, I played the saxophone and clarinet.
Ah.
I was the third saxophone player in the band.
Nice.
I wasn't a hotshot. But we had vocalists and we had tranquilicus and we had comedians, stand-up comedians. The kids were great.
That's great, yeah.
And they did, the pantomime. Mm-hmm. And they mouth-synced with the records and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And they put on a hell of a show. I was very proud to be in that.
Yeah, you probably
and
brought
also,
some joy to them.
And
you
also,
know?
The young men were coming back and they had the GI Bill, and I'll tell you more about how that affected the world. And it changed the United States, the GI Bill.
And so what was post-war like?
Well, 1947, the new cars were coming out. Mm. Remember, we hadn't seen a new car since the beginning of the war.
Right.
So our cars went back to the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
I think the 38 was the last models that came out.
Wow.
Before the war or something. Well, the new cars were beautiful. And they had all that chrome on them. They were loaded up with chrome.
Uh-huh.
And they had no fenders. They did away with the fenders sticking out, and they incorporated the fenders, the wheels into the car. So they had the Kaiser Fraser was the first one to do that, and the Hudson did it, and they wrapped the body around the tires. They
uh-huh.
had never done that before.
Very classy.
Yeah, and they had a swept-back look, and of course the Cadillacs had these huge tail fins.
Yeah.
So that came out, in around 1948. But it was in the 1947 when the models came out early.
Right, right. And so 1948, you were graduating high school at that point, right?
Yeah, 1948. And I said, man, concentrate on getting out of Brooklyn.
No distractions.
It was my mind talking to me.
Yeah.
The Ivy League schools were not clamoring for Brooklyn Public High School graduates. Not only would the kids have trouble paying the tuition, but their families would not be funding the school's endowments. There were no Rockefellers, Fords, or Mellons at Abraham Lincoln High School. My mother enthusiastically pointed out that Brooklyn College was within walking distance of our apartment, and it was tuition-free, and I would stay home in Brooklyn.
Well, I definitely know you don't want to go there. Where did you actually want
to
go?
I'm trying to get out of Brooklyn.
Exactly.
So she's telling me to stay in Brooklyn because it's cheaper.
Right.
And she thought she was going to buy a fur coat with my tuition money. But of Lincoln's 950-plus graduates, I ranked number 12.
Oh, wow. Very impressive.
And I had applied to Columbia University, early decision, and I was accepted. So my mother said, you live at home and you can commute on the subway. I said, Mom, that's a 2-hour trip each way. She says, yeah, you can do your homework on the subway. And my mother had this idea she was going to get a fur coat with my tuition money.
Oh, my. Yeah, it doesn't sound very collegiate.
I wasn't envisioning college as a long commute on the subway. I hadn't heard from Cornell. And that was one of my other applicants.
Top choice, yeah.
And the other one was Swarthmore, which is a friends school.
So, what does that mean?
Friends. They're, a sect, the Quakers.
Oh, okay.
So my father was very kind, and he paid for an overnight sleeper on the Lehigh Valley Railroad up to Ithaca, New York. And I went from Penn Station. And I went up there alone at 18 years old on the train to visit the Dean of Admissions.
Wow.
At the College of Arts and Sciences at Cornell, up in Ithaca. And the interview did not go well. Dean Wright out, boy, I remember it as though it was yesterday. Dean Wright out looked at me. He looked me over, and he buried his nose in my application, and he was not smiling.
Oh, gosh.
And he looked at me, you've been admitted to Columbia. You come from New York City. You'll be happy there, and you will fit in well. I suggest that you plan to attend Columbia.
Well, yeah, I mean, that sounds awful, but, I mean, he was saying that you made it, right? That you
no,
got admitted.
I got into Columbia, not Cornell.
Oh,
I was
no.
being interviewed at Cornell trying to get
no.
out of the state up to Ithaca.
Oh,
he was telling
my.
Me to go to a city call school.
Yeah, like, forget about your dream.
The subway.
Yeah, forget about your dream. Just settle for Columbia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He stood up. And he said, thank you for coming up. And I retreated slowly out of the door. Well, the train didn't leave from the station downtown for quite a while, so I had some time, and I walked slowly around that magnificent campus. Wow, it was beyond words. There were large fieldstone buildings, and they were surrounded by lawns. There were shade trees next to pedestrian paths that crisscrossed the open area between the buildings, and the students were walking in small groups, chatting, laughing, smiling, and the bells were chiming. They had a carol on. The library tower had the bells, and this was it. Wow, this was it, but not for me.
Oh, that's devastating. I'm sure you were crushed.
Oh, man, was I depressed. Oh, man. It was a long, depressing trip back to Brooklyn, and I greeted my mother at the door of our walk-up apartment in Brooklyn, and she called out, "Oh, you got a letter from Cornell this morning."
Oh, wow.
And the letter
read, "What did it say?
We are pleased to accept you." Wow.
Oh, my goodness. You must have been just, so excited.
I had already been accepted
when you had that conversation.
They already mailed out the acceptance. He was giving me the business.
Ah.
And I said, wow, into Cornell and out of Brooklyn.
Yes.
Hooray.
Oh, man, how exciting. That must have been such a turning point in your life, right?
Yeah, well, it would be the start of a new life for me.
Yes.
I never stopped thanking Cornell for accepting me. Right up to this moment, 74 years later, I give them a lot of money.
Yeah, you sure did, right?
Yeah.
And there's so much here that you learned from this experience.
We endow 6 scholarships at Cornell alone.
Wow. So, that's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. And we do other stuff, too. So there's a lot to learn.
Mm-hmm. A lot, definitely.
So one
you
of
went
them,
through a lot.
One of them is to have goals and work towards them. Mm-hmm. Aspire and do something about it. Well, you know, I represented the Catholic Church here in Dade County for 15 years. And the priest used to tell their parishioners, they said, prayer is wonderful and don't underestimate prayer, but you must do your share because God expects you to do your best too.
Yes.
So if you do your best, think good things happen.
Yes.
And that's why education is so important. It's the key, I think, to breaking the chains, the bonds, whether you're a black or a Jew or a woman or a Hispanic, and you want to crack the glass ceiling, you want to get out, you want to break the chain that is pulling you down towards a mediocre, a scrappy life where you have to struggle for your essential things in life.
Yeah,
education is a wonderful tool to break that chain.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah, I mean, wow, there's so much. The fact about having goals, there's also everything that you went through with World War II during all that time.
Right. I'm going to talk to you a little bit first. I'm going to talk to you about World War II later.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to talk to you first about goals.
Yes, tell me more.
Everybody, I find people are very skeptical in the United States. The intellectual people are very, they tell you it's a lot of baloney and it's all, false positive where you pep yourself up and you're enthusiastic and positive and happy and look at the sunny side of things. Optimism.
Hmm.
They denigrate optimism. And I think that's a mistake because I think being optimistic and positive and looking at the sunny side of things and when things go bad, not to let it get you down, to keep striving.
Yes.
That's important.
Yeah.
So we live in a very difficult society and our home life and schools and we have materialism. It's unkind. The schools are unkind. And it's a socially striated society where you are born into a great
to specific box. Class.
You're put into a pigeonhole when you're born.
Yep.
England is worse by far.
Mm.
But we're put in pigeonholes, and it's overly competitive and aggressive, and you have to fight your way out of the pigeonhole.
Pretty much, yeah.
And education and economics, making money,
mm-hmm.
and emotional self-esteem is important. So there's a lot of there's a huge field of motivational books and self-disciplinary books. self-help, if you
will.
Are
there some that you recommend or that you read?
Well, you know, some of them are classics. There's How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Oh, I've heard of that one.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, it sold 30 million copies.
Yes, very popular.
So it's, then there's The Power of Positive Thinking. That was by Norman Vincent Peale. Well, that one, I think, sold as many books. of course, there's no simple answer. We're tilted in most of us who are not the intellectuals are tilted towards self-improvement and optimism. In fact, there's an optimist club. The optimists look on the sunny side, find the positive, and they meet and they sing songs and they have lunch together and they shake hands and they do business. It's like Kiwanis.
Yeah.
So they say, for example, in How to Win Friends and Influence People, they say, master your feelings and improve your conversations. There's a power of mental discipline. Don't trust your gut. Control your mind. Listen to people, you become what you think about. So many people have tried to be good listeners and don't criticize and show appreciation and think of the other person's interests. If you do that, you're smart. It should come naturally. Remember names. Avoid arguments. That can't hurt you.
Common
that's
sense.
Pretty good. Yeah, well, that's pretty good advice. So, and a lot of it, of course, in success is luck. And the Asians appreciate luck. They call it joss. And they have a great belief that it's a river that runs through your life, luck.
Oh, wow.
And they gamble a lot in casinos, which I wouldn't do because the odds are against you. But
yeah.
they think they're going to be lucky.
I think it's when luck meets preparation, right? Like you have to be in the right place. But if you're not ready, if you're not prepared, then it's not going to happen.
It's like prayer. You hope it's there for you, and you hope for it, but you can't rely on it.
Exactly.
You can't say, well, I prayed, I'm going to be fine. You got to do your share.
Right.
I looked at the book, The Power of Positive Thinking, came out in 1952. By the way, that sold tens of millions.
Well, it was after the war, so
yeah,
I'm 52. Sure people were looking for something, you know.
Well, it said, identify the areas you want to change, then check yourself, be open to humor. Follow a healthy lifestyle. Eat, sleep, don't get into drugs or alcohol. Well, of course, that's good advice anyhow. Surround yourself with positive people. Don't get involved with the crowd and about birds of a feather flock together.
Right.
You get involved in a crowd of negative, angry people, it's not going to help you.
It's going to rub off.
If you get involved in a bunch of people who are positive and say hello to you when they meet you and how are you and show an interest in you, those are the kind of people you want to be friendly with.
Mm-hmm.
And practice positive self-talk and look for the good in other people.
Mm-hmm.
And act happy, smile. Don't walk around with a glum face. And, use your arms and your eyes and your shoulders and your body to express yourself, not just to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And don't be sarcastic. And practice gratitude. Mm-hmm. And smile every once in a while. Laugh at yourself and smile.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the things that they teach you in these courses. And some of them, how to influence, make friends and influence people, they teach you how to speak. How to express yourself, because communication is one of the,
it's at the center of everything,
areas where we can improve. And I find today,
definitely,
particularly with people who are younger than I, they tend to communicate by tapping an instrument and you read something and it says, wow, and you don't hear it. Well, they don't pick up the phone and talk to you. So
that's
when
true.
I try to deal with people, I don't, sometimes my computer doesn't transmit the message for a few days.
Right.
So they said, well, on Saturday I sent you something. Well, I didn't get it till Tuesday.
Uh-huh.
Well, it was due Tuesday. So they say, well, I sent it to you on Saturday. Well, pick up the phone and say, hey, I'm sending you something.
Right.
It's going to be due Tuesday. Today's Saturday. I'm giving you a heads up notice.
Mm-hmm.
And listen to the other person's voice.
Mm-hmm.
And in the way you talk, the way you speak, the inflections and the mannerisms of your speech, there's a hidden story.
Yeah. You get to understand where that person is at.
Yeah, you know how urgent it is,
yeah,
too.
Exactly.
You know, my God, we've got a deadline. This is urgent.
Right. You know, so
it's a much better way of life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
So no, those are great. The self-improvement. You didn't know we'd be into a self-improvement study. But it's good because I didn't need that. Mm-hmm. Man, I had a fire burning under my backside from the day I was 5 years old.
Yeah, you're like, I'm getting out of here.
I didn't want to be smacked in the face anymore.
Mm-mm. That was enough motivation, right?
That was a rough. Yeah. Brooklyn was rough. It was very aggressive and competitive.
It's like the negativity. Too. The negativity pushed you to want to get away from it.
Highly competitive. People will do anything to get a little jump up. If I had practiced law in Brooklyn, New York, I don't think I would have had the same success, if you will,
right.
Or the same number of clients, the same activity that I had here in Florida.
It was a lot more cutthroat.
Much, much, much more cutthroat.
Mm-hmm.
So now that we covered self-improvement in Brooklyn and cutting the chains that bind you into your pigeonhole,
We
can talk about what happened with World War II.
Yes.
But that is, if you're an historian or an amateur or interested in history, that's a very exciting period in the United States history.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that they don't cut that out of the history books, because now they're doing away with history, so which is a terrible thing.
Yeah.
But what are the changes in American society attributable to World War II?
Mm.
Well, first of all, what happened in World War II, interesting statistics that occurred in World War II that changed. First of all, what happened is we had 300,000 dead.
Wow.
Well, 300,000 men out of dead, and not just wounded, dead out of the labor market, creates a little bit of a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Russia, they're talking about 17 million dead.
Wow.
So Russians, soldiers killed. So let's talk about America. Well, during the World War II, they had over 1 million men taken out of the out of society and put in the service. 300,000 died, but 2/3 of them didn't. So a lot of them were wounded.
Hmm.
So who took the jobs? Rosie the Riveter.
Yeah, women.
Women charged forward, and life changed.
Mm-hmm.
Society changed from that day on. From the day of the draft, society changed in the United States.
Yeah.
So now you're looking at maybe 6.3 million women working.
Wow.
During World War II. We never had that. No more jobs as secretaries and receptionists and telephone operators. Now the women were in military intelligence. They were flyers. They were nurses. They were factory workers. They were drivers. They were radio operators. They were the waves and the wax and the different types of military they served in.
Mm-hmm.
They had, I think, over 300,000 women serving in the military.
Wow.
They were working wives. Mm-hmm. They had children, but they also were able to work. Now women rose to the occasion and undertook responsibility in the workforce. And they didn't just do physical work. They became managers and executives, and they started knocking on the ceiling, on the glass ceiling.
Good, yeah.
And
at least something good came out of World War
II. Right. Women were no longer inferior. Then what about blacks and Hispanics? They had opportunities too.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, of course, the military was terrible, particularly for blacks.
Yeah.
Because they had them digging ditches mostly. There were a few black organizations. The Tuskegee airmen who were great, and they were flying fighter planes, and they were terrific.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly it was women getting a chance. That was the big thing.
Mm-hmm.
They stopped treating children harshly during World War II. There was no beatings, slapping them around, punishing them. The kids were helping out. They were collecting tin cans and paper and working in the war effort.
Mm-hmm.
Material affluence, 17 million new jobs were created, and industrial production doubled, and corporate profits doubled as a result of World War II.
Yeah, war is profit.
Now these guys were coming home from the military. Their values had changed. They saw death. They wanted to live. So they had material affluence they were looking for, cars and homes and leisure and appliances and televisions. that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And so that whole industry started. We didn't have television until after World War II, and we didn't have appliances, you know, all these things, mixers and blenders and stuff. And we didn't have cars like we had. We had wonderful cars with automatic transmission, hydromatic. Wow.
Yeah, fancy, yeah.
You didn't have to change gears. And, of course, education. Well, education became available to the middle class. So there were the GI Bill, Harvard. A lot of guys I know who went to Harvard Law School would have never gotten in if they hadn't been in World War II. They were returning GIs, and Harvard Law School took them, almost all of them. You applied, and you had enough, you know, credentials to apply.
They would take you.
They would take you if you were a GI.
And is that all the GI Bill did, or did it do more?
Pardon?
Is that all that the GI Bill did, or were there more?
Oh, no. GI Bill, you got a mortgage for your loan for the build a house, to buy a house. I had the GI Bill when I came out of the Korean War, and I got a loan to buy a house.
Oh, that's great.
And with very low interest rates. Or you could buy a car. They'd give you an advance down on some cash, maybe $500 towards buying a car.
Oh, that's good.
Which was a lot of money in those days. And there were a lot of other things, benefits that you had in the GI Bill. Education being the main one. And people who have never gone to college wound up going to college. And that was the start of the state schools and the local schools, the the two-year colleges and the certificates. So that was covered under the GI Bill, and they were paid. The tuition was paid. Then you had more international political change in the United States. We weren't isolationistic anymore. And the UN was formed. So now we participated in the UN, and we participated in Europe. We became involved in international trade for the first time really heavily. Right. So how did that happen? Well, we had an increasingly international involvement, and we became the leader of the free world. And part of it was a General George Marshall. Did you ever hear of him?
Yeah.
He
Sounds
was
familiar.
A four-star general in World War II. And he became a Secretary of State in 1948. And he came up with the Marshall Plan.
Marshall Plan.
Marshall Plan involved $13 billion in economic recovery programs into Western Europe. And they established markets for U.S. goods. So it wasn't just helping Europe. We were giving them the money, Greece and so on, to keep them from going communist, helping, pumping up their economies. And they were using the money to buy American manufactured goods.
So it was a win-win,
Those days we were manufacturing, the great manufacturer, not China.
Right, yeah.
And we had our own labor situation, and we with unions and so forth, but we were producing. And, of course, fashion changed. Well, how did fashion change? Well, women changed. They wore slacks. You never saw a woman in slacks before World War II. You can't, you're very few. They wore shorter dresses. They did fewer hats, no more of the hats. They stopped wearing veils.
Oh, okay.
They stopped wearing gloves.
Definitely showing a lot more.
Men, there were no more vests. They used to wear these vests, and they had pants cuffs. The cuffs were taken off the pants to save the material.
Oh.
And the men used to wear hats. Knox hats were very famous. That business went under. No more hats. You see men wearing hats today?
Nope.
No, no more hats. That's when it stopped. And, of course, no more garters for socks. You know, they had the garters around the calf. So that was a big change in men's clothing. And then you had mobility. Well,
with the cars, a lot more movement, right?
Well, yeah. They moved. People wanted a house on their own piece of land. And there was Levittown, and they moved to the suburbs, and they had tract homes where you could buy a home like everybody else's, you know, but it was wonderful. It was yours. And you had a living room and a dining room. And it wasn't a slapdash cabin of some kind. It was a real house. And you had built-in TV into the wall, you know.
Wow.
Where the TV fit right into the wall. And it was wonderful. You had a carport where you can pull your car in. And those things. And you had community activities.
Right.
And they had a community swimming pool. And some of them had community tennis courts or golf courses. It was a whole change in lifestyle mm-hmm. after World War II. And of course, people left the small towns, and the dwelling in the cities went from 46% in the cities to 53% of the population. Of course, the blacks had been leaving the South and moving to the new northern cities, and that continued. There were two big waves of blacks moving north, and that was part of the Great Depression. So that antedates World War II. But the blacks had done more and felt more involved in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, I found a tombstone that a black man died in the South Pacific combat, a soldier's tombstone. And it said, "Here lies a black man killed fighting a yellow man for the protection of a white man."
Oh, wow.
Now, there were a lot of discrimination in the military still going on. That didn't start to be remedied until Eisenhower stopped it, I think, in 1948. And there were Southern industrialists who were really hostile people. And the Southerners were very, very much into segregation. You had George Wallace and, you know, you had the Hate Selma and the hate marches and the guy putting the dogs on people who were marching.
Oh, wow.
You know, yeah. And one of the Southern industrialists at that time said that he preferred a German victory to racial equality for blacks.
Oh, my gosh.
So they were very hostile. And so that was going on. The fight that had NAACP. The NAACP, you know, that's the National Association of Colored People. That mm-hmm. went from 50,000 to 500,000.
Oh, wow.
And CORE, a lot of whites joined that. And CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, that was sit-ins. They were doing sit-ins. Mm-hmm. That was when the sit-ins started. And then there was the Mexican-Americans, which everyone forgets about Mexican-Americans.
Yeah.
There were 400,000 serving in World War II.
Wow. 400,000. That's a lot.
Yeah. And then we got into the Cold War. The Cold War started in 1945, I think. And George Orwell named it the Cold War. And actually, it started with the occupation and the division of the countries that the Nazis had occupied and we liberated.
Hmm.
So that's Eastern Europe, a lot of it. So you had Poland and Czechoslovakia
right.
and Ukraine
mm-hmm.
and Belarus and a lot of those countries, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, all along that eastern part of the continent of Europe. And there was an issue as to whether there would be capitalism or communism. Well, the Russians moved in and tried anything that they occupied, they tried to incorporate, and that's how it became the USSR, you know, the Socialist Republic. And it finally collapsed in 1991. They got control of all these governments, and people were thrown out of windows from high buildings.
Oh, my gosh.
And they took over. They're not exactly the most humane people, Russian politics. So that was what was going on. A lot of hatred sprung up after World War II that was supposed to be ended with the Holocaust being discovered, and it wasn't. And, of course, the Russians to this day hate the Nazis very much. And so Putin calls Ukrainians the Nazis because
yes,
it rings a bell with Russia. They lost 27 million people in World War II. Half of them were civilians and half of them were military.
Mm-hmm.
So they lost. Civilians were being exterminated. There's no such thing as civilian immunity. We knocked off 100,000 Japanese in one night in Tokyo. Killed them. Anyhow, for Putin, a million Russian lives is nothing. It's not a lot. So he'll go in, and that's what you're facing in Ukraine now.
Right.
He doesn't care if he loses a million young people. It's meaningless to him. Mm-hmm. Stalin knocked off 2 million people who we felt were his political enemies, and he exterminated them.
Yes.
In Russia, Russians. So it's a different world, and we're dealing with different mentalities and different cultural, ethnic people who think entirely differently than we do.
Oh, yeah.
And don't react the way we do. Their concepts of good and bad and right and wrong and evil and nice are not the same as ours.
Yeah. Definitely not.
Well, that's what I have to say today to you about Out of Brooklyn.
Oh, wow. Quite a bit. I mean, you've been through a lot, Louis. And I am so happy that you had the determination and the motivation and the willpower to meet your goal and get out of Brooklyn, because look at everything that you've done. Well, look how far you've come.
Yeah, you know. I did. I'm lucky. And the point is not me. The point is the people who might, the 5 or 10 people who might listen to the podcast.
Right, to be inspired.
Maybe 500,000. But maybe somebody will understand that they've got to get off their behind and do something to improve their own lives and stop whining and crying and do something.
Do something already.
Right.
All right. Thank you, Louis.
Thank you so much.
Until next time.
Thank you for listening. We are excited to announce that Louis now has his own blog. Visit louisrez.com to get insightful commentary to the Miami Memoirs podcasts, along with an analysis of current events, as only Louis can provide.